search for the lab.
He said an estimated 10 million visitors a year will see the exhibit. Research at the lab will also help advance understanding of plant genetics and development of crops with improved characteristics such as drought resistance and improved nutrition. Over the years, the lab has accomplished some very noteworthy science. During the 1990s, Epcot scientists worked on genetically altered peanuts to create a more nutritious peanut oil. Next, they worked with genetically altered peach trees to create peaches that stay firm longer. In the early to mid-2000s, the lab worked to molecularly alter the design for the pear tree. Scientists worked to create a new rootstock for pear trees that would stunt the growth of the trees, making them shorter and easier to grow and harvest. This would make the trees more attractive for industry, as they would be more productive. None of the genetically altered or engineered plants the lab works with ever makes its way onto your plate at Walt Disney World. If you care to learn more about the science and agriculture at the Land Pavilion, there is a Behind the Seeds tour. Information about the tour can be found at the desk located near Soarin', which is our next stop. Now boarding all passengers for an exhilarating adventure. Get ready for a true wonder of Walt Disney World as you prepare to hang glide around the globe with Soarin'. The Imagineers pulled out all the stops when they created this attraction. As you're raised 40 feet in the air, approximately 1 million pounds of steel provide the structure for the ride, and 37 tons are hoisted each time a flight leaves. You're immersed in a 180-degree, 80-foot IMAX projection dome. Your entire field of vision is captivated by panoramic scenes of the world. The attraction is visually stunning, and the sense of flight is realistic. Soarin' offers a bird's-eye view of many of the wonders of the world, and the Smellitizer pumps out smells of the grasses of Africa, the ocean breeze over the South Pacific, and roses over India. All the while, the London Studio Orchestra delights with the attraction's musical score. This is a definite fast-pass attraction. As you're waiting for your flight, if the chief flight attendant, Patrick, sounds and looks familiar, that's Patrick Warburton, known for his work on Seinfeld, Family Guy, and Rules of Engagement. As you walk out of the Land Pavilion, it's hard not to notice the beautiful mosaics that cover both walls of the building. The mosaic is supposed to represent a slice through the earth, portraying the different layers of the crust and the mantle. The mosaic was done by the father and daughter-in-law team of Hans and Monica Scharf. This dynamic duo was also the team that created the mosaics in Cinderella's castle. The mosaic at the Land Pavilion is composed of polished and unpolished marble and granite, slices of brick, Venetian glass, Byzantine glass, ceramic tile, and Venetian mirrored glass, as well as smooth and rippled gold leaf. I had the pleasure of speaking with Claudius Scharf, Hans' son and Monica's husband. He shared this story with me. My dad and wife were given the commission for the mural. They asked Disney for the exact measurements of the mural, which Disney could not provide because the walls were still under construction. Disney flew my wife and dad to Orlando, first class, to measure the wall themselves. They couldn't do it because of the ongoing construction. Disney decided to give the go-ahead based on the drawing because of the lead time involved with doing the mural. It turned out that the drawing and subsequent mosaic were 3 feet greater than the finished wall. My dad and wife and the Disney artist were devastated and were at a complete loss of what to do. I suggested they ask Disney to let the mural flow into the floor. Disney agreed, and thus is the mural on the wall and into the floor, and no one is the wiser. Claudius tapped into his imagination to problem solve at the Land Pavilion. And what do you know? The building next to the Land Pavilion is bursting with imagination. Everyone needs a lovable purple dragon in their lives, so let's go meet the one residing at Epcot. Journey into Imagination with Figment is located next to the Land Pavilion. Before you walk in to meet the little guy, look at the water fountain out front. The water is flowing up as opposed to down. Over the years, Figment has become a beloved member of the Disney family, holding a special spot in the hearts of many visitors to Epcot. Today, he's a host and guide through the Imagination Institute. When you enter the attraction, witty references to Disney movies are immediate. Walking through the hallway leading to the attraction, notice the names on the doors of the Institute. You'll see Dean Finder. This is a reference to Dream Finder, the original host of the attraction. Figment was his sidekick. Losing Dream Finder and the original concept and show behind this pavilion is a bit of a sore subject for die-hard members of the Disney community. The name Professor Wayne Szalinski may look familiar here as well. Professor Wayne is a character from the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Next up, Professor Philip Brainerd is a reference to a character in The Absent-Minded Professor and in a reincarnation of the story via the movie Flubber, starring Robin Williams. As you approach Dr. Nigel Channing's office, Channing is played by renowned actor Eric Idle. Have a listen. It sounds a bit chaotic in there. During your trip through Imagination, you may notice a red and white Letterman jacket with the letter M. This is for Medfield College, the fictional college from the film The Absent-Minded Professor. There are a few other things to look out for during your tour through the sensory labs. When you go through the sight room, see if you can spot the Mickey Mouse head on the whiteboard. When you enter the upside-down room, check out the table with food. You'll find onion rings assembled to resemble a hidden Mickey. In the final scene, Figment is using a piece of sheet music as a hang glider. The sheet has a few bars of the attraction's legendary theme song, One Little Spark. One last story involving Figment may be the most entertaining yet, how he got his name. It comes again from an interview with Imagineer Tony Baxter. Yes, I came up with the name and the idea. Steve Kirk, Andy Gaskill, and X Atencio gave him form. I was watching Magnum P.I. with Tom Selleck on TV. He was in the garden, and the butler, Higgins, had all these plants, and they were all uprooted. It was a mess. Magnum had been hiding a goat out there, and the goat had eaten the plants. Higgins said, "Magnum, Magnum, come out here. Look at this. Something has been eating all the plants in the garden." And Magnum says, "Oh, it's just a figment of your imagination." And Higgins says, "Figments don't eat grass." I thought, there is this name, the word figment, that in English means a sprightly little character. But no one has ever visualized it. No one had ever drawn what a figment is. So here is a great word that already has a great meaning to people, but no one has ever seen what one looks like. So we had a name that was just waiting for us to design the shape for it. I came to work and said, "I have the answer for our show. It is going to be Figment." We had come out with Dream Finder earlier. That was easy. He was a Santa Claus type who is wise and older and knows all the great things, a great thinker. But we needed a childlike character that had like a 1 second attention span and was a little crazy. Another strong part in that show was the presence of the Sherman Brothers, Richard and Robert, the songwriting team from Mary Poppins and It's a Small World. Once again, they were like idols to me. With my role as director, I had the ability to go after top talent. So I said, "I would like to have the Sherman Brothers come in." And they said, "Okay, fine." And I thought, wow, because they were so important to me. They are wonderful. They are such nice guys. What I found right away is that when the Sherman Brothers believe in a show and when they understand an idea fully, they write better music. When they do not feel that good about it, the music has an absence of wonder, since they were not able to sense any magic to build the themes on. It was a fun time and a real challenge because we had to figure out what imagination is. It took us 6 months to come up with a simple thing. You gather, you store, and you recombine. Right now, Didier, you are gathering information from me, and you are storing it, and you are going to recombine it with things you already know and create a new product, which is what you will write. Whether you are a writer or a scientist or an artist or a teacher or someone making a cake, it is the same thing. Gather, store, and recombine. So we gave those words to the Sherman brothers, and they wrote One Little Spark based on that premise. That last story just about wraps up Journey into Imagination with Figment and Future World. But before we tackle the second half of Epcot and the World Showcase, there is one more secret I forgot to mention. Each pavilion or attraction in Future World actually has hidden or secret VIP lounges, accessible to the employees of the company that sponsors the attraction. Let me backtrack a bit here. The Walt Disney Company has traditionally relied on corporate sponsors for both Disneyland and Walt Disney World to defray the costs and maintenance of the attractions they develop. This business of sponsorship was leveraged heavily for the construction of Epcot, both throughout Future World and the World Showcase. An article in the Orlando Sentinel from October 24, 1982, sheds a bit of light on Disney's innovative way to finance their park. They have already made sales pitches from Russia to Japan, but Walt Disney World's globetrotting sales team is on the road again in search of additional participants for Epcot Center. The search is the continuation of one that began 7 years ago and netted more than 20 participants for the billion-dollar project. The Disney Company has relied on sponsors for its theme parks to supply funds since Walt Disney had to muster enough money to pay for his first theme park in the 1950s. In return, the sponsors harvest a promotional bonanza for their products. Now, about 35 companies sponsor attractions and exhibits in Disneyland and Disney World's Magic Kingdom. At Disney World alone, participants chipped in about $8 million in 1981. Epcot's participants will contribute more heavily. They are reported to be paying Disney between $10 million and $50 million apiece over a 10-year period, for a total of $300 million. Some of the cash is in, but Disney is footing most of the startup costs for Epcot, said Jack Lindquist, Senior Vice President of Advertising, Publicity, Promotion, and Public Relations for Walt Disney Productions. Lindquist said the search began in 1975 for Epcot World Showcase participants. The sales team tried working through government channels. They found interest and enthusiasm, but no money. So within a year, the Disney team began approaching private industry, Lindquist said. When we started out, we were very naive and ignorant, he said. The company had not been involved in the international market before. It was a long learning process, he said. Lindquist said other Disney representatives found that foreign officials didn't understand the Disney theme parks. So they began bringing government and industry officials to Disney World to show them firsthand what the theme park is all about. As the Epcot concept expanded to include Future World, the company turned to U.S. corporations to participate in the project. Disney officials used a variety of selling points as they wooed prospective participants. They said the participants' names and products would be exposed to millions of visitors expected to pass through Epcot. Sponsors are allowed to use the Disney name in promotions and publicity. In addition, Lindquist said the company assigned a marketing representative to each participant to help develop promotions. Most participants also will have an office and lounge for corporate use in the pavilions. Although sponsor names will be apparent to visitors, Disney officials have maintained creative control over the shows to keep them from becoming too commercial. Lindquist said the company also relied on advisory boards to keep the shows accurate as well as entertaining. But sponsors will have some areas in which their products will be on display. Kodak sponsors the Journey into Imagination Pavilion. It will feature a ride exploring the imagination process with two audio animatronic figures, Dreamfinder and Figment, as hosts. the ride will not open until December. The attraction also features an area for visitors to tinker with electronic devices producing light, sound, and three-dimensional film. Michael Donnelly, coordinator of promotional activities for Kodak, said it will be difficult to measure the impact of this type of program. But he said the company's intent is not to promote sales per se. He said the company hopes visitors will leave with a good feeling about Kodak. Kraft's sponsorship of the Land Pavilion was a natural because most of the products the company markets come from the land, said Dick Cordes, vice president and director of the Land Pavilion. Cordes said it will take visitors about an hour to tour the pavilion. It will be hard to measure impact, he said. Cordes said he didn't think exposure would prompt the homemaker to go out and buy two more boxes of Kraft cheese. But he said that if a shopper is in the store examining a couple of products, pleasant memories of the land might tip the scales in Kraft's favor. Is the sponsorship a high price to pay for promotion? Cordes said, assuming the cost of sponsoring the pavilion was $50 million, the price would be 50 cents a head if 10 million people pass through the attraction. I can't send them a brochure and a long story for that price, he said. He declined to say what Kraft was paying for its sponsorship. Disney officials will continue recruiting even though Epcot has opened. Lindquist said the company still is looking for sponsors for the Living Seas and the Health Pavilions. He said the company also is working with the governments of Spain and Morocco on pavilions for the World Showcase area. Other pavilions in the design stage include one for Israel and one for Equatorial Africa. There are about 9 more spaces available in the World Showcase, he said. The selling is never easy. But Lindquist said the job will be easier now that Epcot has opened and people have seen it. That's a pretty good overview of the marketing and sponsorship opportunities when Epcot first opened. Most of the original sponsorships and a few original pavilions have gone by the wayside, and many of the VIP lounges have been abandoned. But if you know where to look, you can still see a lingering reminder of what used to be. Spaceship Earth. Siemens sponsored the attraction until October 2017. The lounge is located above Project Tomorrow, Inventing the Wonders of the Future. You can see the windows for it if you're looking at the backside of Spaceship Earth from the center of Innovations Plaza. Mission Space. Hewlett-Packard sponsored this lounge until 2013. There is an entrance down a corridor to the left of Mission Space's entrance. Test Track. This lounge is sponsored by General Motors, current as of 2017. To the right of the main entrance to the attraction, there is a GM plaque on the wall that leads the way. The Seas with Nemo and Friends. The lounge was sponsored by United Technologies until 1998. The entrance is to the left of the entrance to the Coral Reef Restaurant. The Land. Nestle sponsored this until 2009. Chiquita currently sponsors only the attraction Living with the Land. When in the lobby and facing the restaurant, the Garden Grill, you can see the windows of the lounge above the restaurant. Journey into Imagination with Figment. Kodak was the sponsor until 2010. This lounge is actually accessible if you're a Disney Vacation Club member. Flash your DVC membership card, and you will have access to the second floor lounge. You can gain access from the ImageWorks merchandise location within the Imagination Pavilion. Obviously, these areas are restricted unless you're an employee or have permission to venture inside. As stated, most of the lounges aren't currently operating, but may be rented for an event. As the article from the Sentinel states, another area of Epcot where Disney used the sponsorship program was the World Showcase, a kaleidoscope of nations featuring architecturally authentic buildings and backdrops of culture, arts, and entertainment from 11 nations and an African-themed outpost. So leave your passport at home and get ready to stroll around the world in roughly 1.3 miles. Since our last destination was Journey into Imagination with Figment, let's proceed into the World Showcase from the entrance closest to Figment, which would bring us first to the United States' neighbor to the north, Canada. If we started around the World Showcase from the other end, our trip would start with Mexico, our neighbor to the south. Oh, Canada, where do we begin? Let's start with the architecture and theme. The Canada Pavilion is a combination of Native Indian villages, an ornate French-inspired chateau, and the maritime areas such as Prince Edward Island and Nova Scotia, topped off with the ruggedness of the Canadian Rockies. The geographic and cultural diversity of Canada's regions are symbolized and represented with accuracy. There are 30-foot totem poles that mark the Native Indian villages, where a log cabin and its trading post carry out the North Woods theme. In January 2017, two new totem poles were introduced to the pavilion. Carved by Tsim Sheean artist David Boxley, the two poles each tell a unique story. The eagle totem pole tells a cultural tale in which a boy finds an eagle caught in a net on a beach and frees it. Years later, when hunger strikes the boy's tribe, he walks on the same beach, only to find the eagle there waiting for him with food, paying him back for his kindness years ago. The bottom of this totem pole also tells the story of how a family of beavers taught a human family the importance of treating all creatures, human and animal, with respect. The whale totem pole depicts the tale of the first potlatch, a ceremonial feast celebrated by the Naganaks and creatures of the undersea world. After the totem poles were installed, the Githoan dancers, people of the salmon, performed a dedication ceremony. Based in Washington State, Githoan members can trace their ancestral roots to some of the main tribes of Southeast Alaska, the Tsim Sheean, the Haida, and the Tlingit. Another distinctive landmark of the pavilion that will attract your eye is the Hotel du Canada, featuring its 19th-century limestone chateau architecture. Before you reach the building, note the beautiful flower gardens inspired by Victoria's Butchart Gardens, and behind the building are the scenic Rocky Mountains. Forced perspective is in full effect here, and a flowing waterfall. Tucked inside the boulders of the mountain is a theater featuring a film about the country. Funny man Martin Short is your host. He will entertain and inform you of Canada's scenic wonders and culture during the 14-minute Oh Canada Circle Vision 360-degree film. Circle Vision is a film technique that uses 9 cameras for projection onto 9 large screens arranged in a circle, usually above head level. By using an odd number of screens and a small space between them, a projector may be placed in each gap, projecting across the space to a screen. Disney sent their producers to all 10 Canadian provinces and 3 territories during a 2-year period, filming more than a quarter of a mile of film in an effort to catch the essence of Canada. The film plays continuously throughout the day. If you decide to stay for the movie, as you exit the theater and walk up the path, you will pass Canada's restaurant, Le Cellier Steakhouse. It's a great meal. Try the cheddar cheese soup. But you will most likely have a difficult time walking in and grabbing a table. Definitely make reservations to dine here for lunch or dinner. And when you're checking in for your reservation, look behind the check-in desk. See if you can spot the 3 wine bottles arranged to form a hidden Mickey. As we will see during our trip through the World Showcase, each pavilion features the culture, cuisine, architecture, and friendly faces of that country. Disney staffs the World Showcase and, to an extent, some other areas of Walt Disney World via their Cultural Representative Program. Acceptance into the program allows young folks from the countries represented in the World Showcase to come live in America for 1 year or so and work at the park. Disney touts the program to prospective applicants as a way to not only earn money, but experience working and living the Disney way. Those accepted into the Cultural Representative Program will not only work in Epcot, but will live in Disney housing with others from the program. As its website says, whether you're assigned to a 1, 2, 3, or 4-bedroom apartment, you'll share a bedroom with 1 or 2 Disney International Programs participants. Oftentimes, your roommates will be from another country, allowing you to learn about other cultures as you share your own. In addition, you'll improve your communication skills by being immersed in an English-speaking environment. You'll also learn about guest services directly from the company that's showing the world how it's done. Leaving Canada, you'll find that Tudor cottages, cobblestone streets, and architecture spanning Elizabethan to Regency await you in the United Kingdom. Approaching the UK, you'll notice the building's facades change throughout the area. The architectural style is representative of different styles from the 1500s to the 1800s and the locale of Merry Old England. From London Victorian to Yorkshire Manor, Tudor to Georgian, Hyde Park and Regency to a Shakespearean cottage, Imagineers spent 3 years researching historic sites throughout England, Scotland, and Wales. Signs, chimneys, lampposts, and even a bright red English telephone booth lend themselves to the charm of a jolly holiday in London. One of the beautiful parts of Epcot's United Kingdom is Britannia Square, which emulates Hyde Park and features a gazebo and a hedge maze modeled on the one at Somerleyton Hall. The facades of the buildings overlooking this area were taken from the set drawings from Mary Poppins. This would be a perfect setting for a wedding, and if your wallet can afford it, Disney can make that happen for you and your 48 closest friends and family members. Another remarkable detail can be seen at the Sportsman's Shop, which is modeled after King Henry VIII's Hampton Court Palace. The four regions of the United Kingdom, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, are all represented via crests on the windows. Across from the Sportsman's Shop is the Rose and Crown Pub. As you're walking across to the pub, turn back around and look at the sign for the Sportsman's Shop. The soccer ball, tennis racket, and rugby ball form the shape of a hidden Mickey. The sign for the Rose and Crown Pub has a witty phrase on it. In Latin, it's otium cum dignitate, which translates to leisure with dignity, the motto of the Rose and Crown. A few weeks before the pub was scheduled to open, a battle was brewing. According to the employee newsletter, Epcot Center News Brief, from September 19, 1982, 43 degrees cold. It's enough to send a shiver to the soul of a countryman. Drinking in that cold, it has no flavor, you see, said Bill Windsor, the 27-year-old Scotsman who is assistant supervisor of the Rose and Crown. Bill says the ales, lager beers, and stout are at their flavorful best at about 52 degrees Fahrenheit. At the temperatures preferred by American beer drinkers, as low as 38 to 40 degrees, Bill says the brews are merely wet and cold. Randy Hyatt, manager of research and food development for the food division, acknowledges that at 52 degrees, the drinks are smoother and they have good flavor. Yet, from the perspective of an American, they are also warm. It's like drinking Coke with no ice. It's not refreshing. Drinks are being poured at 43 degrees out of deference to the large number of Americans visiting the pub. It appears the American tastes won out. For several years after the opening of Epcot, the pub did use a specially designed ale warmer to maintain your Guinness at a proper 52 degrees. But today, it's typically cold beer at the Rose and Crown. Apparently, Americans love authenticity, except when it comes to beer. Beer drinking accuracy aside, the Rose and Crown accurately portrays the four different styles of pubs found throughout the United Kingdom. As the Imagineering Field Guide to Epcot states, the city or street pub dating from the 1890s Victorian city center features brick and wood paneling on the facade and gives us our elegant mahogany bar, the etched glass, and the molded plastic ceiling. Dickensian Pub, after the Cheshire Cheese Pub in London, offers a brick-walled flagstone terrace with covered tables, a slate roof, and half-timbered Elizabethan-styled exterior. Waterfront, or River Pub, on the canal lock, a facade with a modest stone building, a clay tile roof, and decorative doorways, stone terrace with an iron fence lining the homey Village Inn-style dining room. Country, provincial pub, from the suburbs of the 17th and 18th centuries. A slate roof, plastic exterior, with stone-coined corners. Working our way around the 40-acre World Showcase Lagoon, our next visit is to France. Here at Epcot, we're not taking the Channel, the short name often used for the Channel Tunnel, running from Folkestone in the south of England to Calais in northern France. And we aren't flying. We're walking. But there is an interesting story involving airplanes, the UK Pavilion, and the France Pavilion at Epcot. On October 18, 1982, to celebrate the opening of the World Showcase at Epcot, for the first time in history, two supersonic airplanes, known as the Concorde, touched down within a split second of each other. One plane was from British Airways, and the other from Air France. Both companies were early sponsors of pavilions at Epcot's World Showcase. The two planes typically only flew into New York or Washington, D.C., but due to their involvement at Epcot, Disney arranged for both planes to touch down simultaneously in Orlando. More than 35,000 people witnessed this live. As you leave the United Kingdom, on foot, just before you cross the bridge leading to Pars, you have the opportunity to exit Epcot via the International Gateway. This is also the spot to have a smoke or two. Exiting here, you can walk to the Boardwalk, the Beach Club, the Yacht Club, and the Dolphin and Swan Resorts. If you're really interested in adding some steps to your Fitbit, you can even follow the signs for the walkway to Disney's Hollywood Studios. If you're not that adventurous, just catch one of the friendship boats, which makes stops at the above-mentioned hotels, and then offer continuing boat service to Disney's Hollywood Studios. But we aren't leaving just yet. It's time for Disney's version of The City of Lights. As you cross the bridge into France from the UK, you're walking on a replica of the Pont des Arts, a pedestrian bridge in Paris that crosses the River Seine and links the Institut de France and the central square of the Palais de Louvre. One of the first things to catch your eye is the replica Eiffel Tower, created from the original blueprints drawn by Gustave Eiffel. Epcot's version is roughly one-tenth the size, standing about 103 feet tall. Much like the experience in the United Kingdom, the Parisian cityscape Disney crafted here is the Paris of yesterday, specifically between 1850 and 1900. This is evident as you stroll along and approach the Palais du Cinéma, which is inspired by Château de Fontainebleau, one of the largest French royal chateaus. This medieval castle and subsequent palace served as a residence for the French monarchs from Louis VII to Napoleon III. Ornate and elegant are two great words to describe Epcot's palais, and the appreciation for all things French is only heightened when you watch Impressions de France, the 18-minute film shown at the theater. Much like the experience at the Canada Pavilion, this film showcasing France's grandeur and charm, with a truly amazing musical score from the French composers Debussy, Saint-Saëns, and Ravel, runs throughout the day in a 350-seat theater with a panoramic 200-degree view. It's similar to the Circle Vision view in Canada, but here in France, you're seated. If films about France aren't your thing, don't worry. The food and drinks here are spectacular. If you've always dreamed of a classic French meal but never had the opportunity, Monsieur Paul just may be what you're looking for. Monsieur Paul Restaurant introduces the culture and the authentic taste of French cuisine that Chef Paul Bocuse has been preaching to the world, says Jerome Bocuse, son of the famous French chef and president and owner of the company that runs Monsieur Paul in the France Pavilion at Epcot World Showcase. The decor captures classic French architecture, with bright colors and a touch of modernism. The restaurant inherits the air of hospitality of my father's restaurant, as each staff member goes above and beyond to offer the warmest, most inviting service possible, says Jerome. Monsieur Paul is decorated with mementos of Chef Paul Bocuse's extraordinary culinary honors. He was awarded 3 Michelin stars for 48 straight years at his famous Lion restaurant, Auberge du Pont de Cologne. The Bocuse family has an important place in the culinary world, most recently with Paul Bocuse being named Chef of the Century by the Culinary Institute of America. Monsieur Paul was the name cooks used in the 1950s to address a young Paul Bocuse in the kitchen, to differentiate him from his father, George Bocuse, also an established chef, and the nickname has stuck throughout Paul's life. My father, Paul Bocuse, first opened Le Chef de France here at Epcot in 1982 with chefs Gaston Lenotre and Roger Verga. It was the first and only Bocuse-affiliated restaurant in America, says Bocuse. Things have now come full circle, with me having the opportunity to open a restaurant here bearing my father's name. I've seen the dining scene change, and we are evolving with it. The aim is not to replicate the dishes from the Lion restaurant, but to serve both classics and interpretations of them in a setting that's more contemporary. We want guests to experience authentic French cuisine, but they don't have to dress up and spend a lot of time, says Jerome. We've thoughtfully adapted Monsieur Paul to our guests' vacation experience. If 5-star French cuisine is not what you're looking for, or if you need something on the faster, sweeter side of things, grab a pastry from the patisserie, or kick off your drinking tour of the world with an orange slush made with Grand Marnier, orange juice, and other libations. There are definitely more than a few things to enjoy at the France Pavilion. A relative newcomer to the World Showcase is Morocco, having debuted in 1984, rather than when Epcot opened in 1982. To ensure an authentic portrayal of the country, King Hassan II sent some of his craftsmen to Epcot to collaborate with the Imagineers on the design and construction of the pavilion. From the Orlando Sentinel on September 14, 1984. The Moroccan pavilion is the first to be constructed using government money from the sponsoring nation. Steve Baker, Director of Participant Affairs at Epcot, says most World Showcase exhibits are paid for by private investors and Walt Disney World. Although he won't release exact figures, Baker says the Moroccan government paid a little more than half the cost of building the Morocco Showcase. Walt Disney World paid the rest. Since construction began in July 1983, a similar spirit of cooperation has prevailed between the American tradespeople working on the project and the 19 Moroccan artisans who decorated it. The artisans usually spoke French, the language of commerce in Morocco. You can imagine the kinds of difficulties you might have, says project manager Jeff Burton, but beyond a few communication problems, there were zero problems. The result of the artisans' 4 months of work is an exhibit that overflows with colors and repeating designs and characteristic of Morocco's Islamic art. Ceramic tile, brass lamps, carved plaster, and cedar decorate the courtyard at the pavilion entrance. Ceilings, walls, and floors of the Gallery of Arts and History and the Tourism Information Building, which flank the entrance, are similarly ornate and colorful. Through the courtyard's ogee, or wishbone-shaped arch, are reproductions of the Ketouba and Chella minarets found in the cities of Marrakesh and Chella, respectively, a facade of a traditional Moroccan home, and a copy of the Nejarine Fountain found in the city of Fez. In all of these, ornate Moroccan handiwork is dominant. Absent from these decorations, however, are depictions of living things. Such depictions are forbidden by Islamic law. Less ornate and formal is the retail market, or medina, typical of the older parts of a Moroccan city. As in most medinas, the displays of leather goods, ceramics, carpets, and brass goods at the Morocco showcase spill into the street. In keeping with Epcot standards, however, the market is otherwise immaculate, and the shopkeepers are uniformly costumed. Another interesting story from the Sentinel from May 27, 1984, elaborated on the work of the Moroccan craftsmen. Altogether, 19 Moroccan artisans arrived in Orlando in late January, 8 to carve intricate designs in plaster, and 11 to assemble the tile panels along the walls and columns, most of them working on the site of the pavilion itself. The tile artists, who came from the same cooperative workshop in Morocco with their master, first spent 3 months deciding on the colors and designs that they would later assemble and mount on blank walls at Epcot. They prepared the tiles in Morocco, cutting countless non-representational shapes and packing 9 tons of them in nearly 400 crates for shipment to Lake Buena Vista. Pre-cutting and sending tiles was an economy move, Burton says. That way, all they had to do was reassemble them in panel form and install them. Nonetheless, assembling the lacy patterns that cover most of the space set aside for them wasn't always a cut-and-dried process. The only rule in Islamic art, North Africans are among the most devout, following the ancient laws to the letter, is that geometric designs not portraying living things. Only Allah can create life. But hundreds of individual designs can be combined in countless patterns. When the spirit moves them, artisans are free to make up new patterns. On mounds outside of the work area, near small wooden crates still partly filled with neatly cut stars, bars, crescents, and ovals as tiny as sunflower seeds, are striking combinations that the master tile maker, Khondri Hassani Abdelali, laid out before he returned to Morocco. The artisans work quickly and easily, laying chip after chip along penciled-in boundaries in patterns that they can see only in their mind's eyes. Apprenticed around the age of 7 and skilled in every step of the trade, typical artisans like those at Epcot just look at the design and know how to do it. They've done the same time-honored patterns thousands of times. Once a pattern is complete, workers sprinkle its terracotta-colored back with cement powder and wet it down. That sets up the bond and prepares the panels for grouting. Then, completing the job is a matter of carefully breaking the large panels into smaller pieces to make them more manageable, installing them against walls or columns, and cleaning their colorful surfaces. On your way out of the Morocco Pavilion and into Japan, look on the open door of Souk al-Maghreb. This translates into Gifts of Morocco. 3 brass plates will form a hidden Mickey. Konnichiwa, and welcome to Japan. The Walt Disney Company has a very long history with the country. In 1962, when Japanese businessman Chiharu Kawasaki visited Disneyland, he told Roy O. Disney that he wanted to bring Disneyland back to Japan. About 20 years later, in April 1983, Tokyo Disneyland, the first Disney theme park not on American soil, debuted. Even Japanese Emperor Hirohito was a huge fan of Mickey Mouse. When he passed away in February 1989, he was buried with many of his most treasured mementos, a microscope, a list of his favorite sumo wrestlers, and the Mickey Mouse watch he was presented during his visit to Disneyland in the early 1970s. So it should really be no surprise that the Land of the Rising Sun has a presence in Epcot's World Showcase. As seen in the other pavilions, Disney's attention to detail and replication of centuries-old culture is remarkable. This is first noticed when you approach the red torii standing just at the edge of the World Showcase Lagoon, in front of Japan. If you look toward the bottom of the torii, you'll notice what look to be barnacles around each namaki, or bottom part of the pillars. These barnacles are fake, created to give the illusion the torii has been in place there for a very long time. Torii's have a special place in Japanese society. According to the official tourism website for the Hiroshima Prefecture in Japan, the Great Torii is the boundary between the spirit and the human worlds. The one residing at Epcot is based on the torii at Itsukushima, a small island in Hiroshima Bay. In the pavilion, Disney tried to achieve a sense of balance, simplicity, and serenity with the strategic arrangements of waterfalls, rocks, flowers, lanterns, and pebbles throughout the area. In fact, some of the original designs for Japan were deemed chronologically inaccurate by Disney's Japanese advisors. The designs Disney originally created portrayed a time when there was more of a Chinese influence in the design, which was not something Disney was trying to achieve and replicate, so changes were made. The other iconic feature at the pavilion is the blue-roofed, five-story Goju Noto Pagoda, 83 feet tall, inspired by a shrine built at Nara in AD 700. Topping it is a bronze, nine-ringed soren, or spire, with gold wind chimes and a water flame. According to the Imagineering Field Guide to Epcot, each story represents one of the five elements of the Buddhist universe in ascending order: earth, water, fire, wind, and heaven. If you have the opportunity, find out what time the Matsuriza are playing. They are a group of Japanese drummers who perform at the base of the pagoda. The drumming is rhythmic, impressive, and almost hypnotic. If you're facing the pagoda with your back to the lagoon, to the right of it stands the Shishinden, spired by the ceremonial and coronation hall found in the Imperial Palace grounds at Kyoto. Inside the Shishinden, guests can browse through the world-famous Mitsukoshi Department Store, one of the oldest department stores in the world, founded in 1673. Still facing the pavilion with your back to the lagoon and the Shishinden on your right, you'll notice a castle at the rear of the pavilion. It's based upon Shirasaki-jo, a 17th century castle in Himeji, a city located in Hyogo Prefecture, in the Kansai region of Japan. Shirasaki-jo is one of the best-preserved castles in Japan. In front of the castle is the Katsura Grill. Check out the pond and see if you can spot the hidden Mickey drain cover. As you leave Japan and start walking toward the host pavilion, America, you'll notice a little quick-serve kiosk selling drinks and a delicious shaved ice treat called kakigori. Pick the flavor of your choice. Be sure to order it with the condensed milk. Welcome to the American Adventure. The pavilion is located at the center of the World Showcase and features prominently in your line of sight as you enter the showcase from Future World. This was not originally the plan for the host pavilion. In fact, some at Disney wondered if America should even be represented here. From the book, Since the World Began, Walt Disney World, The First 25 Years. The question of how to present the spirit of America daunted the Imagineers. The United States was not one of the original World Showcase pavilion concepts. It was to be a sleek, two-level structure on stilts in a transitional area near Future World. As the host country, the United States was to have a walk-under facility with an attraction above, a gateway to World Showcase. There was concern that placing the United States in the showcase itself might appear arrogant, but that setting it apart might appear aloof. Finally, the Imagineers decided to celebrate the very spirit that could produce a project like Epcot Center. The United States Pavilion, with its spectacular show, The American Adventure, would become the central focus of World Showcase. With the location of the pavilion determined, there was even a time when Disney considered having the World Showcase as a standalone park located adjacent to Magic Kingdom. It was time to once again secure a corporate sponsor. This time, Disney secured two symbols of America in their own right: American Express and Coca-Cola. Nothing screams America like credit card debt and soda. Each sponsor contributed $30 million for the pavilion. The facade of the American Adventure Pavilion is made of 110,000 bricks, handmade from Georgia red clay, aged for an authentic look and feel. Its central rotunda is approximately 35 feet high, with its dome adding another 10 feet. The 108,000 square foot building we see today is reminiscent of a colonial American manor, indicative of the late 1700s. Places such as Colonial Williamsburg, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, and the Old State House in Boston were the inspiration. The original design for the building was more along the lines of the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., but the Imagineers decided to steer clear of having a building look like a government facility or museum. Instead, what we see today is the People's Mansion, containing a theater where a 30-minute show, The American Adventure, plays continuously throughout the day. Before you enter the theater, there are two other notable attractions to enjoy. Depending upon what time you walk into the building, you may be hearing the Voices of Liberty singing in the rotunda underneath an acoustically perfect dome, which amplifies and purifies the sound. Costumed in garb from the 1800s, Voices of Liberty is a choir of a cappella singers that performs in the Pavilion Rotunda throughout the day. This 8-member group runs through a 15-minute set list of some of America's most beloved and patriotic music. America the Beautiful, This Land is Your Land, This is My Country, You Raise Me Up, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and, of course, Let It Go. Before you enter the theater, take a few minutes to tour the unique cultural exhibit currently on display in the pavilion, Rediscovering America, Family Treasures from the Kinsey Collection, which highlights images, artwork, and artifacts related to watershed moments in American history. As quoted from the Walt Disney World website, representing more than 400 years of African-American achievement and history, the Kinsey Collection showcases the best of the American spirit with a nod to ingenuity and innovation. Philanthropists Bernard, Shirley, and Khalil Kinsey worked with Walt Disney Imagineers to display some of their vast personal collection of African-American artifacts for Epcot guests. Themed to hope, belief, courage, imagination, and heritage, the exhibit provides empowering stories of American history from voices that are not commonly seen or heard. Art and artifacts pay homage to African Americans who helped build and transform a nation. Their stories of determination and courage, from the nation's early days to the present, are at the heart of the exhibit. The Kinsey family's private collection features rare art, documents, books, and artifacts, and has been displayed throughout the U.S., including the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Since opening at Epcot on March 8, 2013, approximately 40 pieces have been on display at the interactive exhibit, where guests are able to use touchscreens to further explore the art, artifacts, and history. Guest-activated lanterns also help bring the history to life, with narration provided by celebrity narrators, including Academy Award winner Whoopi Goldberg, The View, Diane Sawyer, ABC World News with Diane Sawyer, and actress Kerry Washington, Scandal, and more. Now it's time to head into the theater and view the American adventure. Benjamin Franklin and Mark Twain are your guides on this journey through American history. The 1,024-seat theater features elegant Corinthian-style chandeliers, archways, and columns. 12 faux marble carvings, 6 on either side of the 72-foot screen, embody the American ideals of individualism, innovation, independence, and self-reliance. As you watch America's story unfold on a stage measuring 130 by 50 feet, about half the size of a football field, Scenes of American History, featuring 35 audio animatronic figures, appear and disappear seamlessly throughout the show, which, unto itself, is a performance of American ingenuity at work. The choreographer of this computer-controlled show is a movable device under the stage, dubbed the War Wagon. 10 different sets are stored there and are moved forward or backward on cue. The silent 175-ton scene changer is housed under the electronic wiring, electrical connections, and air, hydraulic fluid, and water lines that give lifelike movement to the figures and help create special effects, such as rain. The scene changer, a steel framework measuring 65 by 35 by 14 feet, is as long as a boxcar and twice as wide. Operated by computer, the scene changer moves the sets into place horizontally. The sets then rise into audience view on telescoping hydraulic supports. There are also 7 lifts that bring sets into view from either side and above. More than 24 computers control the entire operation. Once the button is pushed, audio animatronic actors move and speak. Music plays. Lights brighten and dim, curtains open, sets rise, and motion picture projectors roll. The production, 5 years in development, involves some of the most technically demanding staging techniques ever used. Behind the 13 three-dimensional settings and performers, the rear projection screen adds dimension to the settings and transitions between decade-spanning scenes. The rear projection screen is 28 feet high by 155 feet long, and the background film uses more than 3,000 feet of 70mm film. If you follow along closely, any situation or scene portrayed before the invention of the camera or film is shown via artwork or with an animatronic. This was done to maintain the integrity of the storyline. That's a lot to digest, so I will leave you with only a few more tidbits before we head back out to the World Showcase. Listen to the voice of Ben Franklin. His voice should sound somewhat familiar. If you rode Big Thunder Mountain at Magic Kingdom, Will Rogers Jr. recorded the voice of the audio animatronic of his father, Will Rogers. During the scene for the Civil War, the storyline involves two brothers who fight against each other. You'll also hear the song, Two Brothers. Pay attention to the photo portraying the family and the two brothers. Looks authentic, right? The two brothers are actually Imagineers John Olson and Jeff Burke, portraying the dueling family members. The man portraying the father is Bob McCarthy, the patent holder for the Smellitizer. The pavilion has a good number of hidden Mickeys scattered among the paintings hanging in the rotunda. See if you can find them in the following paintings: Building a Future Together, Defending Freedom, Election Day, Reaching for the Stars, and Seeds of Hope. The patriotism even lends itself to the plants outside, as the flowers are often planted around the area in a grouping of red, white, and blue. We're now heading over to the Italy Pavilion. The pavilion was designed to capture the spirit and aesthetics of Venice, more of a Venetian influence rather than total replication. As you approach, you'll notice gondolas are docked and tied to the striped moorings in the lagoon, definitely reminiscent of Venice. Front and center are a couple of recreations of Venetian landmarks, Doge's Palace and St. Mark's Campanile. Doge's Palace, or the Palazzo Ducale, was the seat of the government of Venice for centuries. As well as being the home of the Doge, the elected ruler of Venice, it was the venue for its law courts, its civil administration, and its bureaucracy. St. Mark's Campanile is the bell tower of St. Mark's Basilica in Venice. The real tower is 323 feet tall. Epcot's version measures in at 83 feet tall. Both of these iconic Italian landmarks are found in Venice's St. Mark's Square. If you've ever been to Venice to see Doge's Palace, you may notice something a bit different about Epcot's portrayal. Don't worry. If you've never been there, check out the photo. The buildings here at the World Showcase are reversed. Imagineer Bill Martin didn't want the replication to be an exact copy. He wanted Epcot's Italy to have its own identity and therefore switch the positioning of the buildings. Leaving the influence of Venice and resuming with the influence of Rome, Epcot's version of the Trevi Fountain, featuring a statue of Neptune, makes for a great photo opportunity. The Italy Pavilion doesn't have a ride or a movie or a stage show, but that doesn't really matter, because what they do have is some excellent food. So let's get down to business. The options are great. There's